experiment entomologist, and then did fieldwork in Texas cotton fields and Virginia orchards, delaying his opportunity to set roots and start a family. When he finally did marry, he took his wife on his scale hunting trip, part honeymoon, part official business, to China, where Mrs. Marlett was attacked and killed by intestinal parasites. 4 years later, in 1905, Marlett had worked his way back. He was named head of the Division of Entomology at the USDA. If Fairchild's story had been one of good luck and hard work, Marlett's was a combination of bad luck and the need to work even harder. For him, fighting against invasive insects had become personal. In his earlier days, Marlett believed that insects and fungi were as unstoppable as the climate, undeterred by national borders. But in 1898, he had the type of revelation that makes one sit up in bed. He realized wormy apples and mildewed grapes were just as dangerous as people infected with cholera. Plant diseases could spread quickly over large distances and wipe out entire industries. In the first few years of the 20th century, amid all the excitement about new travel and a world open to America, Marlett tried to explain to anyone who would listen that the same trains, ships, and canals that brought new nursery stock also brought pests, weeds, and diseases. He pointed to the infestations of periodical cicadas on his native plains of the American Midwest. The clouds of humming grasshoppers, he said, were as debilitating as the plague of locusts in the story of the Exodus. Even more alarming, the federal government had left pest inspections to the states, each constrained only to the area within its borders. This patchwork system handicapped the federal government's efforts to deal with outbreaks across state lines, or worse, maladies imported from abroad. An entomologist sees the world through the prism of insects, and everywhere Marlett looked were examples of states spreading diseases, while Washington sat, watched, and did nothing. This was the type of dread that motivated Marlett for more than a decade. And in 1905, at exactly the point Marlett and Fairchild were both rising in the circles of social Washington, attending the same parties and society meetings, the one crop they would clash over, the one that would come to be known around the world as the tree of Washington, D.C., was slowly making its way toward America's shores. After their wedding, David and Marion Fairchild decided they weren't city people. They wanted space and some land, at least enough to have a garden of their own. Fairchild's affinity for plants had rubbed off on his artistic-minded wife, and so, with the freedom of being a newlywed couple and the windfall of a generous dowry from Mr. and Mrs. Bell, David and Marion bought a 10-acre patch of heavily wooded land just outside of Chevy Chase, Maryland. To help their daughter and their new son-in-law sustain life in the suburbs, the Bells gifted them an automobile with an enchanting top speed of 12 miles per hour. Marion, who would later be employed as a wartime ambulance driver, became the first woman in Washington, D.C., granted a driver's license. They both loved the property so much, they camped on the bare land the first day they owned it. "Like children, we waded in the brook, chased the squirrels, and built a fire of twigs beneath the oaks," Fairchild wrote. After they constructed a feeble wooden structure, their mornings were filled with the baking of chickpea muffins. With the extra garbanzos, Fairchild made soup. Finally, after all his travels, Fairchild had his own land, his own canvas to fill with the trees and shrubs that in all his travels had emerged as his favorites. He planted an entire bamboo garden and ordered rootstock from the foreign botanical offices he had visited. He imported ornamental trees from Europe, bitter Chinese melons, even the kudzu vine he had found in Japan, which took great effort to get to root, and then, when it smothered part of the garden, required even more energy to kill it. All Marion wanted, however, were Japanese flowering cherry trees, which she referred to simply as cherry blossoms. Fairchild ordered 125 of them from the Yokohama Nursery Company in Yokohama, where he had spent the recent resplendent summer. The nursery owner, a man named Uhei Suzuki, was so pleased to hear from Fairchild again and to have an American customer that he nearly gave away the trees for free, just 10 cents apiece. 6 months later, in the spring of 1906, the trees showed their pink blossoms for the first time, and with them came buzz, the type of buzz in the days before major movie stars that only horticulture could produce. Fairchild spent the early mornings walking amid the budding trees, their petals speckled with dewdrops against the gray sky of dawn. He carried his camera, a new one that could magnify the blossoms, filling the full frame with the delicate beauty that had so taken him in Japan. Word of the Fairchilds' exotic pink trees brought so many onlookers to the front yard that Fairchild ordered 300 more as a gift to the city of Chevy Chase. This was especially notable for a suburb of Washington. The capital city itself wasn't terribly good-looking in the early 20th century. The most impressive part of Washington was its design, its streets clean and angular, wide and efficient. But you couldn't put a city plan on a postcard, nor could one gloat about the new Washington Monument, impressive but clumsily placed. The Potomac lapped near the obelisk, encasing the area in a perennial field of mud. Thomas Nelson Page, the man married to Barbara Lathrop's sister, gave a speech to the Washington Society of Fine Arts on May 4, 1910, calling for someone to do something to beautify Washington. "We are much given to claiming that Washington is now the most beautiful city in the country, and one of the most beautiful in the world. In fact, we are much given to claiming that whatever we are the most of that," he argued. "But if I may say so, without giving offense, this mental attitude, which is essentially that of the provincial who knows little of the standards by which comparison is made, is unworthy of a great people." Page's larger point, that a city's capital is symbolic of its stability and its aspirations, had for years distracted the ego of America's proudest supporters, none more than Teddy Roosevelt. In his second term, Roosevelt prioritized giving Washington the stately facade afforded the shiny capitals of Europe. He urged Congress to fortify the raw land around the Washington Monument with sediment to transform it into a park. Ideas poured in from visionaries who imagined a future of beaches, polo fields, baseball diamonds, paths for walking and bicycling, and a separate road for automobiles to pass at greater speed. This area would come to be called the Speedway, and it struck several people that the flowering cherry trees could lend the tidal basin an elegant visage. Fairchild wasn't the first person to think downtown Washington and the cherry trees could make a dignified pair. Eliza Sidmore, a journalist and Washington networker, one of the few women involved in the National Geographic Society, had been enchanted by flowering cherries for years. Her brother was a consular officer in Japan, which brought her regularly across the Pacific, most memorably in 1887, when she first saw the trees. But in Washington, her exuberance was lost in translation. It was, perhaps, because the political environment wasn't right, or because she was an eccentric woman in a town of self-admiring men, that her pleas were answered with cynical questions. People wondered, why bother with cherry trees that don't produce cherries? Fairchild's trees, however, had proved the draw of cherry blossoms, not for their fruit, but for their annual pink bursts. Every tree Fairchild imported brought demand for two or three more. For a time, he nearly became a plant importer filling personal orders. Still, delighted by the interest, Fairchild saw the cherry trees as an opportunity to inspire young kids into botany. On Friday, March 27, 1908, which happened to be Arbor Day, he invited one boy from each school to visit his home, which he and Marion had begun to call In the Woods, to receive a tree and planting instructions for his schoolyard. The next day, a Saturday, Marion drove Fairchild into town to give a lecture to students and parents from all over Washington at the Franklin School at 13th and K Streets. Fairchild invited Sidmore, whom he introduced as the most noted writer on Japan. He described his travels, as had now become a popular part of any speech he gave, and recalled his first view of the Sakura in Japan. He ended his lecture by displaying a photograph of the unsightly speedway near the Washington Monument. What an excellent place, he mused, to plant cherry blossom trees. The next morning in the Washington Star, Fairchild's parting thought was given front-page treatment. If the trees were planted soon around the tidal basin speedway, they could bloom the following spring, and not long after, the newspaper reported, Washington would one day be famous for its flowering cherry trees. Here was an example of Fairchild's suddenly high standing as a member of the Bell and Grosvenor families. What Sidmore had tried to accomplish for decades, Fairchild influenced with the lightest of touches. It wouldn't be long before the United States had a new president, William Howard Taft. And as the people of Washington were starting to like the idea of bringing cherry blossom trees to the capital city, America's first lady, Helen Taft, was warming to it too. While Mrs. Taft marveled over their beauty, her husband saw a diplomatic tool. America was a Western country born from the influence and customs of Europe, and Americans saw Asia as foreign, in both distance and concept, and had long rejected elements of its cryptic culture. It would be easy to dismiss this attitude as ethnocentrism, Americans shunning foreign people less for who they were than how they looked, faulting them for taking American jobs, as labor leaders did in San Francisco in 1905. In 1907, Japanese and Korean people in some cities were forced into segregated schools, and elsewhere attacked on the street. Japan had been at war with Russia over land in Manchuria and Korea. Giddy newspaper editors in New York ran headlines about the prospect of war in the Pacific if the conflict escalated. To diffuse this tension, Taft's predecessor, Roosevelt, had thought a truce was the most sensible solution. In the agreement, America would stop mistreating Japanese people, and Japan would stop sending immigrants to America. The agreement was childish, effectively a time-out separation that reflected poorly on everyone, most of all the United States. It was clear to anyone who bothered to look that the country that had built its foundation on being open to everyone had become racially selective in deciding who was welcome. But President Taft knew the Japanese better. As Secretary of War in 1905, the same year Fairchild got married, Taft had visited the Imperial Country, where he was welcomed to the harbor of Yokohama with a fireworks display in his honor. Now as president and motivated to smooth over relations, Taft quickly realized that the cherry trees could be the perfect way to quell the antagonism. Importing trees was more palatable than importing people, especially ones vying for jobs. To Japan, it was an opportunity to show off a beautiful piece of itself in America's capital. Japanese officials also enjoyed the tacit admission that despite America's larger size, population, and economy, the countries were, in a way, equals. An editorial in the New York Times saw planting Japanese trees in the heart of America as an extraordinary opportunity for Japan. There is nothing in the American life to illustrate just what the cherry means to the Japanese people. But suppose we had some symbol of nature that would embody all that Plymouth Rock, all that the Declaration of Independence, all that the Emancipation Proclamation means, of liberty, patriotism, union. And then, suppose our president should on some occasion, with the greatest care, select 300 of the choicest specimens of this emblem and officially send them as representing the felicitations of the American people to a friendly power at the time of some important celebration. Can you imagine what such a gift would mean? So, when the mayor of Tokyo was tasked with finding the 300 finest cherry blossom trees in the city to be uprooted and shipped to America, it became his top priority. The agreement, it appeared, had something to please everyone. Everyone except Charles Marlett, who didn't want foreign plants in the first place, and would see to it that even one damaging insect would leave him no choice but to march up the steps of the White House and make it his mission to undo everything his childhood friend was trying to accomplish. The initial plan for 300 trees turned into 2,000. Tokyo's mayor, Yukio Ozaki, was so excited about playing a part in high-level diplomatic relations that he continued selecting trees until the steamer that would sail across the Pacific was so full it couldn't hold another twig. The trees were selected young to ensure a long life in Washington, and their roots cut short to conserve space on the ship. A year had passed since Fairchild brokered the gift between the State Department and Kogoro Takahira, the Japanese ambassador to the United States, and the paperwork had involved the extended bureaucracies of both governments. Fairchild had begun the negotiations, but when they rose to the highest levels of government, the lead person became James Wilson, now in his 12th year as Secretary of Agriculture. On November 13, 1909, Wilson notified the Plant Industry Office in Seattle that a shipment of high importance would be arriving on December 10th. There were many reasons to be excited about the shipment. There was the diplomatic success politicians imagined when the trees would be photographed near the Washington Monument. For ordinary people, there was the anticipation of something new and beautiful coming to town. And for the botanically minded like Fairchild, there was the promise of biological exchange enriching both countries. The trees reached Seattle as expected. Port workers packed them onto temperature-controlled rail cars and cleared the track ahead for the 13-day trip to Washington. Fairchild saw little reason to worry about something as innocuous as cherry trees. Hundreds had already been planted in the United States, most on his personal orders. Compared to the invasive plants and animals that had wrought damage on United States soil, honeysuckle, water hyacinth, tumbleweeds, flowering cherry trees seemed as harmless as field mice. But this exchange wasn't his alone to handle. While Fairchild had helped generate support and excitement for the exchange, Marlett had visited the same government officials to caution of the dangers. Marlett had even walked across the National Mall to the State Department, where he argued to Secretary of State Philander Knox that the whole idea was poorly thought out. The trees hadn't yet arrived, which to an ordinary person might have granted them the benefit of the doubt that they were clean. But to Marlett, the fact that no one had yet certified the trees clean was almost definitive proof that they were dirty. Secretary Knox believed the diplomatic benefits outweighed any biological risks. But to be safe, Knox took Marlett's warning to Taft anyway. Taft was the kind of man who had trouble making up his mind. Broad-shouldered and powerfully built, Taft had been the hand-picked choice to succeed Roosevelt, who left office so popular his endorsement for president could have gotten a fern tree elected. The support allowed Taft to avoid the slugfest and maneuvering required in a typical election, which might have proven to the public, as it did 4 years later when he lost in a historic landslide, his shortcomings as an executive. In some ways, Roosevelt and Taft were similar, both progressive and averse to corporate power. But Taft was cautious and careful, less out of thoughtfulness than nerves. He doubted his decisions and, when challenged, allowed his mind to be easily changed. He had enjoyed the nitty-gritty of being a lawyer who served as Solicitor General, Governor of the Philippines, and Secretary of War, all positions that allowed him to obsess over fine points of policy and law. He hated granting interviews or being photographed, in part due to his 300-pound heft. Roosevelt had once offered Taft an appointment to the Supreme Court, but Helen Taft had urged her husband to finish his work in the Philippines and leave open the prospect of his own presidency. Roosevelt liked that idea better and began to tout Taft as the torchbearer for a third Roosevelt term. Taft, however, showed that to be an imperfect promise. While Roosevelt had been a charismatic barnstormer eager to create new things, Taft was a stodgy introvert, burdened by the demands of the presidency and insecure in his capacity to fill it. Marlett, by way of Secretary of State Knox, had not been able to change Taft's mind, but the prospect of catastrophe did give Taft some pause. He ordered the trees inspected thoroughly at the garden storehouse near the Washington Monument before they were planted. Fairchild, who was by now America's leading expert in Japanese flowering cherries, was asked to complete the initial inspection. Marlett insisted on being present, too. When the two pried open a crate, Fairchild's first thought was that the trees looked too big and their roots cut too short. This left them vulnerable to corrosion on the month-long voyage from Japan. The Japanese had sent large trees not out of spite but out of generosity, for mature trees would show vibrant blossoms the fastest. Fairchild believed they could be salvaged. Perhaps the tops could be pruned to reduce stress and allow the trees to recover from the trauma of transport. Young stock would undoubtedly be in a much more healthy condition, and the importation of it would have been accompanied with much less risk, Marlett would later write. But Marlett had bigger concerns than the health of a single shipment. The trees didn't look right, and when he closely examined the roots, he noticed small insects. Serious infestations, he wrote, his words almost dripping in I-told-you-so glee. The roots were plagued with root gall, two kinds of scale, a curious new species of borer, and six other dangerous insects. Marlett could make out the Chinese diaspis, a white scale insect known to kill trees by ruthlessly feeding on fruit. He spotted the wood-boring Lepidopterus larvae that survived by gnawing on trees' woody insides. And there was the well-known and unwelcome San Jose scale, which Marlett noted, despite its name, originated somewhere in China. In spite of his enthusiasm, Fairchild was forced to agree with Marlett that insects could present a risk to American soil. He was accustomed to unusable crop. Not every seed or cutting had to be treasured. But what worried him most was how to break the news to the president that the trees, the symbol of friendship in a fraught diplomatic relationship, were faulty. And that America, which had already rejected so much about Japan, would have to reject its trees too. There was no delicate way to handle this, and the situation brought Fairchild anxiety. Every sort of pest imaginable was discovered, and I found myself in a hornet's nest of protesting pathologists and entomologists who were all demanding the destruction of the entire shipment, he wrote. It wasn't hard to foresee a surge of support for people like Marlett, the nativists who wondered whether it was worth it to import plants at all. Farmers across the United States had enjoyed the benefits of plant exploration, but newspaper reports tended to focus on the hazards. The same kind of hysteria that pushed the United States into Cuba, the Philippines, and the Pacific Islands now fueled frenzy over the costs of imperialism. Were the benefits of a few novel fruits worth the possibility that new pests could take down America's entire agricultural system? Editorials quoted past examples of the Hessian fly that demolished cereals, or the rude English sparrow that fought native bluebirds for space and food. All did damage, but the implication was that their biggest sin was that they sounded foreign, unwelcome in an ego-boosted country that fancied itself superior and, in every way, exceptional. Really, though, this sort of country-to-country contamination was largely inevitable, particularly amid globalization. Doors were open, and it was better to deal with invaders that entered the United States in government labs than on the shoe tread of future travelers. The United States couldn't build a wall to keep out unwanted things any more than places like Egypt or China could prevent their prized crops from being taken by David Fairchild. But what made this unfortunate situation worse was the potential for agriculture to affect other issues of diplomacy, like trade, tourism, and military alliances. A foreign country could easily interpret the American aversion to natural diseases not as a prudent protection of its natural assets, but as hardened xenophobia. Marlitt's report about the tree's infestations gave Taft little choice, and on January 28, 1910, the president ordered the trees burned. Fairchild thought of making one last attempt to save the trees, to prune them himself and spend several days tediously combing the roots of six-legged intruders. But it was no use. Everyone familiar with Japan's sharpened sense of cultural pride braced for Tokyo's reaction, and the likelihood that America's attempt to bridge relations with the Japanese had been sullied, perhaps forever. As Marlitt and his team propped the trees together like a teepee, someone invited reporters to watch them be lit aflame. A news item appeared on the front page of the next day's New York Times. The Washington Post ran a two-page article about foreign plant danger. "See," Marlitt and his henchmen effectively told the public. "Thank goodness we were on the case." And yet, the overall reaction wasn't one of satisfaction. America may have sharpened its ego, but it hadn't lost its sense of decency. Did the destruction have to be so public, so transparent? Couldn't America, with its outsized creativity, have imagined a way for everyone to save face? Someone wrote an anonymous letter to several different East Coast newspapers questioning what good the rebuke to the Japanese had done. "To destroy the cherry trees, to tell the Japanese government that it had been done and why, and to let the story get out, well, that, to transpose a familiar phrase, was more wise than nice. Perhaps it wasn't even wise. The thing to have done was to have some carefully arranged accident happen to those trees before the time came for setting them out, an accident of the obviously unavoidable sort, a clear act of providence. Then the needful number of departmental secretaries could have told Japan how sorry we all were, and the incident would have passed without embarrassment or humiliation for anybody." The letter might have been written by Fairchild, angry and sad, yet with enough scientific sense to know there wasn't much choice. More stinging was that the blaze of trees had granted fuel to those fearful of the unknown. An unfortunate mistake by the Japanese gardeners offered American xenophobes something to point to as proof the world was really out to contaminate the shiny armor of the great United States. The trees and their crates burned for a little over an hour, and when their embers died, so did much hope of patching relations with the most developed country in Asia. Yukio Ozaki, the mayor of Tokyo, happened to be visiting Washington when word got out about the bonfire of cherry trees. He had come several weeks prior to witness the reception of Japan's prize symbol in America's capital. Not long after the trees were burned, Ozaki received David Fairchild in his hotel. Fairchild had come to apologize, or in a less dignified way, to grovel for the biological blunder. "No one was at fault," he explained, "even though a man of his experience could certainly have packed the shipment from Japan with more diligence and finesse to improve its chances of arriving healthy." But Ozaki had a different reaction than anyone expected, illuminating just how little American leaders understood foreign relations and cross-country diplomacy, particularly with the poorly understood Far East. In reality, Fairchild's apologies were dwarfed by Ozaki's. While Washington cringed at the insulting gesture of burning a gift, Tokyo had apparently viewed the problem as having given a faulty present, as though its token of kindness had turned out to be a bouquet of disease. "We are more satisfied that you dealt with the trees as you did, for it would have pained us endlessly to have them remain a permanent source of trouble," Ozaki explained. "Of course the trees had to be burned," Ozaki said, "and if President Taft would still entertain the exchange, Japan would like to send over another shipment of trees immediately. Better trees this time, packed by experts." No one felt happy about the course of events, but it surprised American officials how deferential and apologetic Japan had been in response. One could have easily interpreted this deference from Japan, long, proud, and polite, as a sign of America's stature, an admission that Japan needed America's respect more than America needed Japan's. Mayor Ozaki's wife, in a fawning letter to Helen Taft, apologized again for the mishap, and then characterized the second shipment of trees as a memorial of national friendship between the United States and Japan. Gardeners and chemists from several of Japan's islands were brought to Tokyo to help select another batch of sakura, the expectations higher this time to get it right. A famous Japanese chemist named Jokichi Takamine was tapped to oversee the process and was told the second shipment could not be mishandled. 3,020 trees for Washington were selected as an insurance policy, and to hold them, a bigger boat that could cross the Pacific faster. The trees were raised in virgin sod and their roots wrapped in damp moss. The trees were fumigated twice with hydrocyanic acid gas to asphyxiate any insects, and then placed in cold storage to slow the tree's metabolism. Charles Marlett wasn't pleased upon hearing of a second shipment, but he considered it a small victory that the first shipment, with its faults on display to the public, had proved his point. Biological imports couldn't be left to chance. The incident had successfully undermined the pipe dream that everything that showed up on America's shores would come exclusively with benefits and no risk. Fairchild, too, had been encouraged by the arrival of the second shipment and the verdict, after they received a minute and careful examination, that the trees were clean, young, and healthy. 4 years to the day after Fairchild's 1908 gift of the trees to Washington schools, on March 27, 1912, Mrs. Taft broke dirt during a private ceremony in West Potomac Park, near the banks of the Potomac River. The wife of the Japanese ambassador was invited to plant the second tree. Eliza Sidmore and David Fairchild took shovels not long after. The 3,020 trees were more than could fit around the tidal basin. Gardeners planted extras on the White House grounds, in Rock Creek Park, and near the corner of 17th and B Streets, close to the new headquarters of the American Red Cross. It took only two springs for the trees to become universally adored, at least enough for the American government to feel the itch to reciprocate. No American tree could rival the delicate glamour of the sakura, but officials decided to offer Japan the next best thing, a shipment of flowering dogwoods, native to the United States, with bright white blooms. Meanwhile, the cherry blossoms in Washington would endure for over 100 years, each tree replaced by clones and cuttings every quarter century to keep them spry. As the trees grew, so did a cottage industry around them, an elite group of gardeners, a team to manage their public relations, and weather monitoring officials to forecast peak bloom, an occasion around which tourists would be encouraged to plan their visits. Eventually, cuttings from the original Washington, D.C. trees would also make their way to other American cities with hospitable climates: Denver, Colorado, Birmingham, Alabama, St. Paul, Minnesota. Considering the trees were at first rejected and then accepted, Marlett and Fairchild both had grounds to claim an element of victory. But the philosophical clash between them would grow bigger. The fight between men who had started as boyhood friends would wind up winner-take-all, the victor to define whether America would embrace the unknowns of the world or run fearful from them for the entire century to come. Part 4. Chapter 16. The Urge to Walk. Being a husband delighted Fairchild. Marion never tired of asking questions about his travels and botanical interests, and either genuinely or out of wifely duty, she adopted Fairchild's boyhood fascination with Java. The two would have a son together in 1906, Alexander Graham Bell Fairchild, who later in life joked that David's vow to take Marion to Java was the only reason she married him. The domestic harmony, however, came at a cost. In just 3 years, Fairchild had transformed from bachelor to husband to father, and with the obligations came restrictions on his travel. In the days after Fairchild had cabled word of his marriage, Lathrop, in Egypt, responded with a lengthy letter conveying a measure of resigned congratulations from an old stag. He seemed to see Fairchild's happiness as his own, and at 57, he watched his protege acquire something that, either by choice or by fate, he had never been able to. Despite his inexperience, Lathrop couldn't help but offer advice for marriage, revealing that he fancied the idea of being a superior husband, and imagined in another life the type of spouse he'd be. March 18th, 1905. Shepherd's Hotel, Cairo. My dear boy, your letter telling of your hope, or yearning, rather, reached me 3 days ago. The cablegram arrived last night, telling me of your happiness. After dancing around the room in a highly undignified manner for one of my years, and giving several cowboy whoops, I immediately cabled you. I am made happy in the belief that you have found a woman whose taste will agree with yours, and that the two of you will be better mated than single. You have an honest, affectionate nature, but to your credit, be it said, woman is even more of a mystery to you than to a mere worldling like myself. Your years of hermiting left you a more earnest man, but also a more ignorant one. So take heed to this advice from a battered old bachelor, one who, as you know, holds good women in the highest respect. Don't bore your lady love to a too incessant attention. Give the other men a chance, and she will enjoy your talk all the more after their empty prattle. Don't be stilted in writing or speech with her. Naturally, you write an excellent letter and talk intelligently and entertainingly, but when you put on social frills, you are a failure. Your education and association have been on thinking lines. When you leave those, you are very apt to flounder, where a city ass would gaily prance along. God forbid you should talk to anyone on scientific subjects only, but don't try to be kittenish. Few women can stand a dullard, but not one worth knowing can long care for a man who tries to appear what he isn't. So my advice to each one of two experimenters in the marriage game can practically be summed up as follows. Be natural, but not insistent. Be more anxious to give than to take. Be comrades. You ought to be a married man, and I am delighted to learn that all the chances for a happy life are in your favor. God bless you, boy. My one regret is, no more tramps together. Yours affectionately, Barbara Lathrop. The poignant letter, with exceptional honesty, betrayed the depth of Lathrop's affection. And yet, of all Lathrop had written, the last line held the greatest weight, the indelible mark of something irreversible. Indeed, the tether of an early 20th century marriage effectively clipped Fairchild's wings. He had become like a shipwrecked boat, happy in its location, but immobile nonetheless. While this normally wouldn't be a problem in bigger government offices with a diversity of ages, Fairchild wasn't only the head of the Office of Seed and Plant Introduction, he was the brains and thrust behind the entire operation. For more than 7 years, his travels and shipments had brought the largest quantity of new fruits, flowers, trees, and shrubs to America. He had spent years arguing that plant hunting was important work. Now, anchored, he needed more people to do it. Three men were already on assignment for the department, one looking for alfalfas in Russia, another for dates and olives in the Mediterranean, and the third in Cuba, hunting the best tobacco on earth. The Strand, a monthly magazine famous for being the first to publish Arthur Conan Doyle's mystery stories, would put Fairchild's team on equal footing with Sherlock Holmes, calling them envoys of agriculture. But Fairchild was unmoved by breathless reports. He knew from experience that what all three men lacked was the burning curiosity for newness, the instinct to feel around in the dark and stumble headlong toward the unknown. Sitting in his office day after day, Fairchild fixated on China, a land still full of hidden treasure that no Westerner had fully explored. His written inquiries to botanical authorities there were misunderstood or ignored. One letter from an Irish friend of Lathrop's living in Sichuan contained the unhelpful advice, "Don't waste time in postage. Send a man." A younger Fairchild, the one who bumbled through Corsica on a shoestring, might have gone himself, unaware of the risk and willing to confront challenges. But that was before he was married, and before he had been spoiled by Lathropian luxury. Who else was suited for such dangerous work? "He's a strange fellow," said one of Fairchild's assistants one day. A bit erratic, perhaps, for he doesn't seem to care about staying in one place. The man under discussion was Frank Meyer, a Dutchman working in the department's greenhouses, who seemed antsy and unfocused, as though yearning for an adventure. A man qualified, if not perfect, for the open position of China Explorer. Frank Meyer was indeed spirited and peculiar. He had gravitated toward horticulture out of childhood curiosity. He was also idealistic. He grew up in an aspiring utopian society, modeled after Henry David Thoreau's Walden. Before coming to America in 1901, he had been the assistant of the renowned Dutch geneticist Hugo de Vries, who had first published the theory of genes. Yet Meyer was also impatient. After he had immigrated at age 25, he planted trees at the Missouri Botanical Garden, propagated saplings at an experiment station in California, and then worked as a junior gardener for the USDA in Washington, D.C. At each job, he became so restless, being stationary, that he eventually quit. Meyer had an obsessive lust for plants. At the age of 12, when his parents had asked what he wanted to do when he grew up, he said he wanted to travel the world studying edible plants. His father replied that they were too poor for him to study science, so he had better learn something practical, like making musical instruments. Meyer left Holland to escape this fate. He wanted to touch and taste trees and shrubs, to subject every plant to his senses. His feelings bordered on familial. He looked at plants with compassion, patience, and a sense of devoted affection. This oddity, one that most people would have dismissed as a quirk of an uncultured man, deeply impressed Fairchild as the unteachable skill required for discerning among plants. It was a characteristic sight to see Meyer quickly pick off and chew a fragment of a dried plant, Fairchild observed, or smell furiously some plant material in order to bring to bear on it all of the powers of his remarkable memory. Curious to size up a man hungry for discovery and adventure, Fairchild invited Meyer for an interview. He came sweating so profusely his clothes were soaked through. Withholding judgment, Fairchild noted, his eager face was sparkling with the real light of a born traveler. Meyer's credentials were sterling even in a field occupied by few, but there was something eccentric about him. He sat with eyes wide open, transfixed on the wall behind Fairchild. He asked questions in deep, Dutch-inflected speech and then answered them like a one-sided interview.
What don't we know of the world? Well, there is so much, Meyer said quizzically.
His mastery of plants was savant-like. And an even more remarkable and valuable characteristic, he loved to walk. Several days before his meeting with Fairchild, Meyer had walked to Mount Vernon, 20 miles south of Washington. He had once walked across the Alps to explore orange groves in Italy, and had marched hundreds of miles across Mexico. Now, if given the chance, he wanted to walk across China, a territory known to have so few roads, the only way to cross it was on foot.
Better small and fine than large and coarse, he would say about crossing China, even if no one quite knew what that meant.
Here was a man, perfect for the task, a botanical explorer uninterested in money, glory, or luxury, who would march across one of Earth's most dangerous but botanically rich regions. If Meyer wasn't qualified for Fairchild's roster, there wasn't a man alive who was. The first question was how to introduce Meyer to Marion and Marion's famous parents, the Bells. Fairchild took Meyer shopping and bought him a green dinner jacket. The Bells loved him immediately. Never mind his wafting body odor, or scruffy cheeks, or his aversion to eye contact, or his tendency to become unfocused by lengthy tangents. In an instant, Alexander Graham Bell could tell that Meyer was endlessly interested in learning. That alone made a man worth knowing. Meyer left on his first trip on July 27, 1905, with papers to remain in China for 3 years. Red tape and bureaucratic obstacles had become so arduous that Fairchild might have called off Meyer's mission, if not for the agricultural largesse Fairchild knew would be waiting in the faraway country's interior. The same way Egypt offered the most advanced farming methods, Central Asia promised actual crops that had benefited from several thousand years of human selection to work out kinks. At Fairchild's request, Meyer's first assignment upon arriving in Peking, the city one day to be known as Beijing, was to find the grindstone persimmon, a swollen seedless variety, which Fairchild remembered from his own initial visit to southern China, that makes its appearance on the Peking market and has become a favorite with so many Europeans there. After that, Meyer was to follow the wind, guided only by his taste and intuition. Meyer met Charles Marlett one time before he left, in passing and in a hurry. The same instinct that gave Fairchild confidence in Meyer's capability filled Marlett with suspicion. Not only was Meyer, a Dutchman, a living embodiment of untested foreign things in the United States, he was going to a region festering with the unknown. The same plants Fairchild had called plant immigrants, Marlett called plant enemies. To Marlett, Meyer was like a spy crossing enemy lines in an oblivious act of betrayal. Marlett couldn't stop Meyer's trip. The Bureau of Entomology that he oversaw didn't have the jurisdiction. Nor, in 1905, could he have put up bureaucratic roadblocks for all imported plant material. Marlett did, however, decide to turn his outrage over Fairchild's recklessness into action. And as Meyer prepared to depart the country for a long voyage across the Pacific, Marlett began to formulate his plan to make sure people like Meyer wouldn't be able to contaminate the homeland with his and Fairchild's fanciful delusions of biological harmony. This animosity was lost on Meyer, who instead found himself showered with excitement and praise. The Washington Post would splash Meyer on the front page, calling him the Agricultural Department's Christopher Columbus. The Los Angeles Times began a long-running series on the dangers facing Meyer: Chinese outlaws, murderous thieves, rampant disease. "This is what agricultural explorers are doing," the paper wrote, "going to all parts of the world in search of new and hardier varieties of grapes, grains, alfalfas, and all other products of the soil, which might be imported to America and add to our farm and orchard wealth." The reports of Meyer's bravery and later his heroism were clearly embellished, but even Fairchild, the seasoned plant explorer, knew little of what Meyer might confront. Both of Fairchild's stints in Canton had been in luxury. He had stayed in Western hotels and ridden in wicker chairs on men's shoulders. Meyer carried only papers to confirm his identity and enough money for food and postage. He brought a chunk of silver to shave off for bribes, along with chemicals for preserving seed, drugs in case of illness, and several surgical instruments. "In these trips, a man must be his own doctor, preacher, and devil," the Post reporter wrote prophetically. This treacherous solitude is what Meyer craved most. "I am pessimistic by nature," he had once told his friends. "I withdraw from humanity and try to find relaxation with plants." Now the moment had come to feed his recluse spirit. A pessimistic Meyer looked optimistically over the rails of his steamer bound for China. Just days before he left, Meyer had written his family in Holland how lucky he was to get such a beautiful job. He wrote to Fairchild that he was committed to "do all I can to enrich the United States of America with things good for her people." And so, when the ship reached Shanghai, Meyer wanted nothing more than to pick a direction and walk. 3 years had passed since Fairchild last occupied the cabin of an ocean liner with Barbara Lathrop. Their tour around Africa had been their last together. When Fairchild returned to America and entered a new phase of life, Lathrop lost his rudder, the person who gave purpose to his constant motion. Lonely and anxious, he simply continued globetrotting in luxury. For what he knew, it was all he was good at. He picked up young men here and there, trying with each to recreate the magic of his partnership with Fairchild. One came close, named Drummond, the son of a friend from the Bohemian Club. Drummond had the wide-eyed ineptitude of an earlier Fairchild, but lacked the spark and promise. Fairchild's life was on an incline during his years with Lathrop, but Lathrop saw his own peak during their jaunts together, and afterward began to peter off. He wrote to Fairchild not long after their travels together ceased. "I never dreamed I'd so sadly miss the daily plant talk, the collecting, the shipping, and the news of success or failure. Before these plant trips began, sight of quaint places and peoples made travel an unwearying pleasure. Now it fails to satisfy me as it did, and during the past year I have been in some measure blasé, as I never was in all the years past. I don't acknowledge it, or permit myself to show it, but much of the keen interest is gone, and I begin to wonder as to what the future has to offer one of my restless spirit. However it ends, it will be all right, and I'll not whine, for I have lived at least two lives in one, as compared with those other garden wall snail men, and can spice my mental gruel with memories of past feasts. Such melancholy missives showed just how much Lathrop had changed since their first meeting on the SS Fulda, the Atlantic steamship where Fairchild encountered Lathrop's peacocked ego, then big enough to fill a dozen steamships. Fairchild remembered their years together wistfully, but he had little time to dwell on such memories. "The work of plant introduction is going on at such a frightful pace that I have been pretty nearly snowed under," he dictated to Marion to send to Lathrop. He made no mention of the glory days or Lathrop's malaise, either because he didn't miss them or because he was too occupied with the present to consider the past. Fairchild had other things to think about, and not all of them botanical. Every day America was changing, in ways large and, often, even larger. Every year between 1903 and 1908, a miraculous period kicked off by a pair of Ohio brothers realizing man's supernatural dream of flying through the air, had been a sort of annus mirabilis in American history. Fairchild knew Orville Wright. The younger of the two brothers visited his and Marion's house in Chevy Chase to see the cherry blossoms, and Fairchild had dined with him at the Cosmos Club, the networking hub where Fairchild met Gilbert Grosvenor, the man who introduced him to National Geographic and, ultimately, his wife. Fairchild was one of many people who asked why Orville and his brother kept their early flights so secret. The mystery had cost them credibility, especially as others were making public attempts at extended flights. The answer, as both Wrights repeated often, was to protect their design from being viewed and stolen, even though, with the hindsight of history, this precaution was mostly unnecessary. Still, Orville struck Fairchild as smart and ambitious, even if his appearance, baggy pants, oversized jacket, and dirty cap, lacked crispness. They also had a mutual friend, an army lieutenant named Tom Selfridge, whose father was an acquaintance of Lathrop. In 1905, Selfridge was a young man, age 23, who received permission from President Roosevelt to pause his military service to join a group of men investigating flight. His eagerness to see man airborne and eventually glide through the air himself had made him, incredibly, the protege of Alexander Graham Bell, Orville and Wilbur Wright, and an engineer named Glenn Curtis, despite all competing against each other to demonstrate a heavier-than-air flying machine. None of the men minded Selfridge's dueling associations, except for the Wrights, who suspected him of spying for Bell. "I don't trust him an inch, but he makes a pretense of great friendliness," Orville told Wilbur. Selfridge's great friendliness eventually won over Orville, who in 1908 granted Selfridge the chance to become history's first airplane passenger during a test flight at Fort Myer in Virginia. When the plane holding Orville and Selfridge dived unexpectedly, Selfridge also became the first person ever to die in a plane crash. Fairchild was partial to Bell out of family loyalty, and also for his father-in-law's proven record of earth-changing invention. Moreover, Bell envisioned that the elusive secret to suspending man in the air would be tetrahedral kites, an idea that seemed more plausible than the oblong biplane the Wrights were developing in Ohio and North Carolina. Bell created a large board of tetrahedral cells, then affixed a single seat for a man to sit in. The only restraint would be the tightness of his grip. History awards the Wright brothers credit for the first manned flight, just 12 seconds, in North Carolina in 1903, even though a shortage of witnesses led to widespread skepticism. As the Wrights were refining their design, Bell, Curtis, Selfridge, and a host of other aspirants were doing the same to theirs. By 1907, Scientific American was offering a silver sculpture of an eagle with spread wings sitting atop a globe to anyone who could fly a full kilometer in the presence of a representative from the magazine. The contest had the effect of reducing the field from many aspirants to just two: the scrappy Wright brothers and the more established and better-funded union of Bell, Curtis, Selfridge, and a Canadian engineer named Douglas McCurdy. The Bell team spent the summer of 1907 experimenting with every imaginable way to get off the ground. Biplanes, kites, it hardly mattered. The year's most valuable currency was time. After each test, the men would gather to compile notes and observations, discussing necessary adjustments before the next flight. Bell, in his characteristic knickerbockers and beret, always requested more information from the group. A man motivated by grand visions of innovation had an equal hunger for detail. He would stay up all night examining measurements, plotting physics equations, and troubleshooting failures. The rising sun signaled his bedtime, after which he'd sleep until 10, and then rise for more tests and measurements, the more minute the better. He believed large discoveries were the sum of small ones put together. That same summer, Fairchild and Marion were visiting the Bells at their estate in Bedeque, Nova Scotia, on a sprawling peninsula that had taken Dr. Bell decades to amass. A little parcel here, another there, until it all added up to 600 acres, which Bell had named Bain Brea, Gaelic for the beautiful mountain that rose at the end of the landmass. At the peninsula's tip, nearly touching the water, was the mansion of all mansions, a red brick palace with more than a dozen rooms for the grandchildren and future great-grandchildren to explore. Fairchild watched from a hillside near where bald eagles nested and swooped for fish as the group made one flight after another, each for longer time and greater distance, yet all short of a kilometer. The hill was littered with kites, some more than 30 feet long, discarded after failing in some way. I sensed vaguely in 1907 that I had arrived at Bedeque at a critical period in the development of the heavier-than-air flying machines, Fairchild later wrote. Bell's group made meaningful progress. The next summer, in June of 1908, Glenn Curtis invited the Fairchilds to watch him attempt the Scientific American Challenge in Hammondsport, New York, in a new biplane called the Junebug, named by Bell in tribute to the delicate flight of the June beetle. On America's birthday, July 4, 1908, the Fairchilds arrived for the attempt, the weather overcast and windy. The plane wasn't much to look at, in Fairchild's words. Frail but trim, with its struts, wires, and white canvas surfaces mounted on bicycle wheels. But Curtis had been a maker of motorcycle engines, and the main requirement of an early flying machine was a powerful engine with enough thrust to leave the ground. Curtis showed the confidence of a man who had it figured out. After a thunderstorm delayed the attempt, judges used a lengthy string to measure a full kilometer, along an abandoned racetrack, over a potato patch, and beside a vineyard with sharp fence posts capable of piercing a falling man. The engine roared. Curtis, his long brown hair blowing in the wind, guided the plane 30 feet in the air. The flight was so loud people covered their ears, but no one covered their eyes. Curtis touched down with an ungraceful bump that bordered on a crash. He was unhurt, as was the plane, but he had landed short. Though running out of daylight, Curtis was determined. Fairchild and the rest of the crowd helped push the plane back to the track where it had moments ago lifted off. Curtis lifted off for a second time, flew over the crowd and over the mark, and then a little farther. People squealed when Curtis emerged from the plane. Even the grouchy skeptic from Scientific American acknowledged that the feat had been accomplished and the trophy won. Curtis's achievement was notable in that it was documented. Man had flown, people had seen it, and a magazine of scientific repute had confirmed it was true. Yet this was a stunted achievement compared to the aviation milestone still to come, the hours-long test flights by the Wrights, Charles Lindbergh's 1927 transatlantic odyssey, and the great jets that would one day drop bombs on the other side of the world. But men of science, like Fairchild and his father-in-law, Bell, had great respect for the first breakthrough, the proof of a concept. A glass ceiling could be shattered once. After that, latecomers could only break the pieces into smaller and smaller shards. That brief afternoon at Hammondsport had changed my vision of the world as it was to be, Fairchild wrote. There was no longer the shadow of a doubt in my mind that the sky would be full of aeroplanes, and that the time would come when people would travel through the air faster and more safely than they did then on the surface of the earth. The future had come, and Fairchild, again, had a front-row seat. Exactly 3 days after Curtis's famous flight, on July 7, 1908, Frank Meyer returned from China. His beard was longer, his eyes sunken, his skin worn like the leather of his boots. He had grown his fingernails so long over 3 years that they curled upward. The excitement around the office wasn't as much because of the arrival of Meyer as it was the story behind the seeds and saplings he had sent from China, and also from Manchuria, Korea, and Eastern Siberia, which he had decided to walk across, too. People wanted to know the story behind each one. From Shanghai, Meyer had sent seeds and cuttings of oats, millet, a thin-skinned watermelon, and new types of cotton. The staff of Fairchild's office watched with anticipation each time one of Meyer's shipments was unpacked. There were seeds of wild pears, new persimmons, and leaves of so-called Manchurian spinach that America's top spinach specialist would declare as the best America had ever seen. Meyer had delivered the first samples of asparagus ever to officially enter the United States. In 1908, few people had seen a soybean, a green legume common in central China. Even fewer people could have imagined that within 100 years, the evolved descendants of soybeans that Meyer shipped back would cover the Midwest of the United States like a rug. Soybeans would be applied to more diverse uses than any other crop in history, as feed for livestock, food for humans, notably vegetarians, and even a renewable fuel called biodiesel. Meyer also hadn't come empty-handed. He had physically brought home a bounty, having taken from China a steamer of the Standard Oil Company that, unlike a passenger ship, allowed him limitless cargo and better onboard conditions for plant material. He arrived with 20 tons, including red blackberries, wild apricots, two large Zelkova trees, similar to elms, Chinese holly shrub, 22 white-barked pines, 18 forms of lilac, 4 viburnum bushes that produced edible red berries, 2 spirea bushes with little white flowers, a rhododendron bush with pink and purple flowers, an evergreen shrub called a daphne, 30 kinds of bamboo, some of them edible, 4 types of lilies, and a new strain of grassy lawn sedge. And his grand finale, 2 rare white-cheeked gibbons for the National Zoo, which attracted reporters in a way plants couldn't, and generated handsome publicity for Fairchild's office. It was clear his voyage hadn't been easy, nor had it been glamorous the way Fairchild's high-end odysseys with Lathrop had been. Meyer relayed how Chinese villagers eyed him as a Western devil. People watched him wash his naked body in bathhouses, sometimes full audiences gawking at the sight of a white man. Rumors spread regularly in 1906 that foreigners could be massacred at any time. He avoided death, but in February of that year, he was mugged and beaten bloody. His only defense, which allowed him to cheat death dozens of times, was a heavy sheepskin coat he wore during all seasons and that projected a strong man underneath. It was big, bulky, and irreversibly stained with layers of dirt. He wore heavy boots and a round wool hat, and let his brown beard grow untamed, altogether presenting a portrait of a frightening-looking man who may harbor fighting skills, or worse, contagious diseases. He was beaten several more times and nearly strangled to death at least once. He confronted hungry bears, tigers, and wolves that he managed to either outrun or outsmart. In all, over 3 years he regularly marched 20 miles a day. The man who loved to walk had found his adventure, a continent as filled with danger as it was unending. Meyer had proved even more adept at plant hunting than Fairchild expected. His packing was meticulous, his seeds perfectly clean, all laid on beds of wrung-out peat moss to prevent drying out or molding in transit. Meyer rejected the trappings of fancy hotels and guest houses for modest inns and local food, saving the department and the United States government thousands of dollars. Even more impressive, he had come in early and under budget. He had written his itemized plant lists on thin paper to save postage. The accountants didn't scrutinize his receipts, they marveled at them, all orderly and with angular Chinese scrawls. Fairchild held a barbecue at his home to celebrate Meyer's success. Around a bonfire, Meyer regaled the office with stories of the Orient, a fashionable term for where he had been. He described Chinese quirks like when villagers were awestruck at the candle inside his flashlight. He recounted how people tugged his boots and pants and stared at his blue eyes. He imitated the bandits and recreated the beatings in Siberia, and described how he slept on brick beds swarming with vermin and hung a mosquito net to protect himself from the locusts falling from the ceiling. During at least one winter, he said, he withstood temperatures of 25 degrees Fahrenheit below zero. The cold was especially inconvenient when he came to an inn where a foreigner had written on the wall, in French, Hotel of 1,000 Bedbugs. Meyer had to choose between sleeping outside in the cold and building a fire that would fill the room with smoke and activate the bugs. He chose the warmth and constructed a makeshift bed by pushing together 3 small tables. Another discomfort, he recalled, was the stench. When I tell you that chamber pots and water closets are unknown, you may imagine the rest. Still, the hardship had been worth it, both for Meyer and for America. It wasn't yet clear, but one of the greatest successes of Meyer's life had occurred on his first expedition, a world-changing find that he had almost missed.